Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
And welcome everyone. In the second half of today's show, I'll be talking with a modern-day Dr. Doolittle. Animal communicator Tim Link says that many people have a special bond with animals, especially children. But as we leave childhood, we also leave behind our natural abilities to communicate with them. Tim says every animal has a tail, T-A-L-E, and we'll find out what that means around 12:30 today. But first, if you've ever had your heart broken, my first guest today says that grief is a normal and natural reaction to loss. What's not normal or natural, he says, is the way that we've been socialized to think and cope with loss. In fact, the ways that we have been socialized can create more problems than not. I'm very pleased to have Russell Friedman back on the show. He's been working to help people recover from loss for more than 30 years. Along with his business partner, John James, Friedman has pioneered more than 2,500 grief recovery outreach programs throughout the world. He's an expert on recovery and has often been called upon by the media, including CNN and Today Show, in times of trouble. Russell Friedman, welcome.
Hi, Vicki. Nice to hear your voice again.
And it's good to have you back. I enjoyed talking with you last time, and this was really great work and certainly made me think on a couple of different levels about different things. I want to say, first of all, the name of the book is The Grief Recovery Handbook. It's the 20th anniversary expanded edition. So this book has been around for more than 20 years, right?
Absolutely. And here's what's interesting. How this book, this edition came about, is a couple of years ago, one day I get a notification that the then version of The Grief Recovery Handbook was the number 4 best-selling book, nonfiction, in all of Denver, which is a pretty big city.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to my partner, John W. James, who's the founder of this institute and the original author of the book, I said, John, this thing you wrote and that we have rewritten together is timeless. It is universal. Now, we already kind of knew that, but to get this thing from Denver, it was like, oh my gosh, this is something that is so universal, so helpful, no matter time and place, that we need to kind of honor it, and we need to add some of the things we've learned over the last 20 years that are in addition to what was in the original book. So this new expanded edition includes not just dealing with death and divorce, but it also includes some specific help on dealing with loss of health, loss of career, and loss of faith. And the career and money stuff, as we all know, is huge. In this last year and a half, which happened with the worldwide economy, it's become even more of an issue than it ever was for more people. So it turned out to be timely to get this out there to help people with things other than just death and divorce.
Absolutely. And I was amazed. It made perfect sense when I was reading the book to say that we do grieve and we do mourn for, you know, loss of money, loss of health, loss of job. And I was surprised by how similar the process is in many cases. But first of all, I want to say, you say that grief is one of the most neglected and misunderstood processes of all. It's misunderstood by us as grievers. It's misunderstood by us when we're trying to help other people go through the process. I wonder if we'd talk about that for a little bit.
Sure. And in order to do that, let me just wrap. We, as you know from reading the book, there are 6 major myths that we identified that limit people in their ability to both grieve and then grieve and complete their relationship to loss. So that when people say you've got to let go and move on, you can't do that because you don't know how, because it was taken away from you very young. So the 2 major myths that most kind of demonstrate why it's difficult to do something normal. Remember, you said correctly something we say, that grief is a normal and natural reaction to loss, yet the vast majority of information we all learn in our cultures, in our homes, in our schools, we're not blaming anyone here, learn isn't normal, natural, or helpful. And here's the first clue. A little girl or boy, we'll say a little girl, comes home from preschool with big tears in her eyes, and her parent, her mommy says, or daddy says, what happened? And the little girl tells the truth with tears attached, the other little girls were mean to me, to which the parent makes a colossal blunder in response and says, honey, don't feel bad. Here, have a cookie. You'll
right.
feel better. Now, the child has told the truth about how she feels, and she is told not to feel bad. Now, if you had said to me that you feel good, would I tell you not to feel good? No, that would sound silly. But the parent says, don't feel bad. And here, have some sugar wrapped around this little flower here, and then you'll feel better. Question, does the child feel better or does the child feel different? And the answer is different. Now, so from the gate, we are taught that feeling bad is bad, and we are taught to medicate it with a substance.
Right.
Then are we surprised we have a culture where there are a couple hundred thousand obesity-related deaths every year, and a culture in which alcohol and drug abuse is pandemic because we're taught by our own parents to medicate our feelings with a substance.
Mm-hmm.
And so the start point for the problem with grief is we're not supposed to feel bad in the first place. And then one of the biggest other myths we all learned, I don't care where we grew up, in America and England and Scotland, and I don't care, France, Germany, we taught that we had to be strong or be strong for others.
Oh,
well,
yes.
Well, being strong means mask your feelings, Vicki, and don't show others how you feel.
Right.
Now, if you're not supposed to feel bad in the first place, and if you're supposed to mask your feelings, and if you're supposed to grieve alone, which is a huge myth, you know, if you're going to cry, go to your room. Now we're 0-3, and we got a kid who's 5 years old who's already been taught that she shouldn't be feeling what she's naturally feeling. So again, grief is normal and natural, but that information of those three myths I just laid out are unnatural.
Hmm.
So I'm not surprised when your question comes up, why don't people do better with grief? Because they were taught not to.
Right, right. And I want to define what grief really means as well, because it's not just the loss of something. You explain it as being, it's about the conflicting feelings that we have.
You bet. And I want everybody, just even if you're driving a car, pay attention to the road as you listen, but listen to this definition of grief. Grief is the conflicting feelings caused by a change or an end in a familiar pattern of behavior. Obviously, if someone was alive, someone important to you, and they die, that's a huge change in what is familiar for you. If you get divorced, it's a change in what is familiar in a relationship. Now, moving is probably the biggest hidden loss in the world because nobody knows that definition, or they not enough people. But watch this. When you move, everything familiar changes. And it doesn't matter, Vicki, if you move from a small house to a big house, from a poor neighborhood to a rich neighborhood. It is not that part of the move. It's the end of familiar. And our brains don't like anything they don't know. Our brain wants to go back to what it already knows.
Even if we're looking forward to the move?
Absolutely. Now, mm-hmm. now watch the conflicting feeling. I'm excited about moving to a new house, but I'm scared or sad about leaving the one I lived in. Okay?
Right, right.
And you might not know you're scared, and scared might be too big a wrong word, but my brain wants to identify everything and recognize it. The new is unrecognizable. The change is something, uh-oh. And the brain likes a thing called stasis, which is unchanged. It wants to go back. Now, let's take that definition and show that it isn't always about sadness, because like you just said, even a move to a better house, that's not sad on the surface. Sad isn't the key word. Changes. Here's the thing. Have you ever heard or read about people who have won major lotteries all over the world?
Mm-hmm.
And how 90% of them or more lose all of the money within 3 years.
Yes.
And
yes.
How all of them wind up in therapies that they didn't need before. Not to mention the fact that they discovered they have more cousins and relatives they ever heard that they never heard.
Right.
But so the issue there is what happens? Why does it become a grieving thing? Because everything familiar changes. If I know myself at a certain level, certain financial level, how I identify myself, and I all of a sudden have a lot of money, my whole identity has changed. Okay, so winning the lottery is a huge grief issue because everything familiar changes. Now, here's an interesting part of that. The 10% or so who are not negatively affected by winning the lottery and who don't lose all the money are the ones who were wealthy to begin with because it doesn't represent as big a change to them.
Okay, makes sense.
Okay, so the key to grief is change. Now, grief isn't just about even these things. Your wedding day, anyone's wedding day, has conflicting feelings. It's exciting and wonderful to have a mate and a spouse and all of that implies. At the same time, it can be a loss of freedom. And you know, now all of a sudden I'm accountable to you and I'm for my time. I can't come and go as I please. birth of your child, a wonderful, awesome, incredible feeling. At the same time, oh my gosh, I'm responsible for this other human being. So all events, positive or negative, graduation, very exciting. I finally did it. I got my grades. I'm going off the road. Oh my gosh, now I have to support myself. Oh my gosh, I'm going to kind of lose contact with all these friends and teachers and everything. So all life events that represent change, represent grief. And the problem is if we're taught not to feel bad in the first place, or we have to be strong, or other absurd things like time heals all wounds, which is another one of the myths, then we're trapped in having feelings that we don't know how to express or no one lets us express.
Mm. Well, that's a great introduction to grief. So we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, I'd like to look at some of the common myths that we absolutely need to let go of, because you have a great action plan for moving forward from loss, regardless of how that loss comes to us. My guest is Russell Friedman, and his book is The Grief Recovery Handbook. It's the 20th anniversary expanded edition. It's been around for a long time, but it's got brand new information in. And you're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Please stay with us. We'll be right back.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
If you like to read fiction, check out Book Talk Podcast Reviews, brought to you weekly by Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Go to conversationslive.net and click on the menu at Book Talk to hear reviews of an eclectic range of books. We review fiction from chick lit and mystery to suspense and literary, from new to old, overlooked and forgotten. Check out Book Talk Podcast today at conversationslive.net. If you'd like to suggest a book for review, email info@conversationslive.net or call 206-414-6159.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, talk radio to help you live well, live strong.
Independent programs, independent voices, independent ideas. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Just you wait and see. And welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. My guest is Russell Friedman. His book is called The Grief Recovery Handbook. I want to ask you, Russell, first of all, you know, you say this in the book. You say, nobody wakes up one morning and decides, yes, I'm going to get into grief and spend my career in grief. How did you come by doing the work that you're doing? How did it evolve?
A total fluke. A great question. I 22 years ago, one day, a woman friend of mine said she was going to this little event by the airport where there were a couple of speakers. Did I want to come? I said, oh, okay, I'll go. So I went, paid $45, and that day changed my life, because on that day, the speaker for the whole day was doing a one-day version of grief recovery. And the speaker was John W. James, who's my partner now. And that day, something happened. I learned on that day that grief wasn't just about death, and it wasn't even just about divorce. Mm. By the way, at that time, I was on the heels of my second divorce and a bankruptcy for $500,000. A lot of money any time, but 22 years ago, really a lot.
Yeah.
And so something happened to me on that day, and it kind of opened my eyes, and I got the card of this fellow, John W. James, and the next day, I was sitting in my apartment. I didn't have a car anymore because I'd gone bankrupt, and my car had been repossessed, literally. And I sat there, and I looked at this card, and I said, I think I'll call this guy. So I called the number, and the phone answers, and the fellow says, Grief Recovery Institute. And I said, John W. James, please. He said, speaking. I said, oh, hi, I was at that thing by the airport yesterday, and I just called and wanted to call and thank you. And he said, you're welcome. And then there was a pause. And then a voice came out of my mouth, Vicki, and this voice said, and I want to volunteer to work for you. I looked around my apartment. I was the only one there, and I could hear this really long pause at the other end where John, who I now know very well, is going, who is this guy? I mean, I could have been an axe murderer for all he knew.
Right, right.
And he said, well, can you come up tomorrow and we'll talk about it? So, and if John takes over the story at this point, he would say, so Russell came up one day 22 years ago, and I haven't been able to get rid of him yet. So now he's my friend and my partner. We write books together. And so I got into it tell you the truth, Vicki, by following an intuition that to this day I still don't understand, and I've got to tell you, it was the greatest single thing I've ever done for myself in my life, because although I have helped hundreds of thousands of people indirectly and directly, I have probably am the most helped person and the happiest human being, because 22 years ago today, I would have traded my existence with anyone, and today I wouldn't trade with anybody. Because by getting complete with my past, not only the divorces and the bankruptcy, but with my relationship with my dad that had been very checkered, it has freed me to be who I am. And the gift of grief recovery is getting back your heart and soul, whether it was affected by a death or a divorce or an awkward childhood. So there's so many benefits of this that sometimes I know when you talk, when people talk to me or hear me on the air, they hear a passion for this. And it's really from the results in me. And I show up here 22 years in a row every day excited to help people because, guess, I get to feel good every day. Well, and people ask, isn't it depressing? I'd say, no, everybody I talk to feels at least some hope that they can. There's something they can do. Remember, you said it's about actions? We teach them the actions, not just talk. It's about doing something to help complete what's unfinished. And that's what we do every day.
Well, we're glad you're with us, Russell. And I think it says Dr. Stephen Covey who said we teach what we most need to learn. So there's probably a lot of sense in you actually teaching that, at least way back when. But I want to get into what we normally think of as the grieving process, which was pioneered by Dr. Kubler-Ross. Denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance. You debunk that. I wonder if you talk a little about that for us.
Absolutely. Elizabeth brilliantly changed the face of dying in this country by having an awareness and a concern for how dying people were treated. They were essentially warehoused in hospitals as packages, really, with no one paying attention or caring or helping them. And in the process of uncovering this mayhem, this horror, she discovered that some things she defined at first, she defined them as the stages of receiving catastrophic news, which was essentially, if you were or I went to the doctor and you're told you have leukemia, you have 6 months to live, the stages, which are called DABDA, the ones you just enumerated, denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance, that she indicated that you're liable to go through these stages on your way to being accepting that you were going to die. And those stages have been contested by a lot of people. They eventually went from being called about catastrophic news to be shortened to the stages of dying. They never were the stages of grief. They were stages that a dying person might go through.
Okay.
And what happened is over time, in the absence of better information in the area of grief and grief recovery, in other words, after someone important to you has died rather than you dying, the whole world kind of adopted this idea that there were stages of grief. They never were to begin with. Now, very late in Elizabeth's life, just before she died, she co-published a book with a fellow called On Grief and Grieving, in which they kind of morphed the stages over to grief. The truth is, we don't agree with that at all. For example, denial being the first one. I have personally, and this is a big number, I have personally talked to 70,000 grieving people. I've been doing this for 22 years, and I tend to talk to 15 or 20 people a day. Do the math. It's a huge number. I have yet, Vicki, to meet one person in denial that a loss had happened. Because they call here, I say, Grief Recovery Institute. What happened? They tell me, my mother died or my husband left me. There is no denial that a loss has occurred. So it doesn't work that way. Now, when it comes to anger, the vast majority of people I have talked to have evidenced no anger in their words, in their tone, or their stories.
That's the one that's always fazed me.
What's that?
That's the one that's always fazed me. I remember a couple of times in my life when people told me, you need to get angry. And I couldn't.
Because it wasn't there.
Right.
Well, you know, this is interesting. Without us throwing stones at anyone, we hear stories all the time about someone who goes to a mental health professional or a clergy or a 12-step sponsor, and so I'm really having a hard time since my mom died about a year ago. I just don't have any energy. And then have some professional say, well, that's because you're in the anger stage. No, I'm not angry. I'm just kind of lethargic and sad. I just can't get back in the rhythm. You know what I mean? Yes, that's because you're in the anger stage. And then your answer is, yes, I'll be angry if you send me a bill. Now, again, we're not here to throw stones at anyone. We're really here to educate. There are no stages that are universal or accurate. accurate for anyone. The real key is that everyone, every relationship that has ever happened on planet Earth is unique. There are no exceptions. And every one of us is unique in our relationship to information and misinformation about laws. So at Grief Recovery, we always want to help someone find out what is true for them rather than me having an opinion. How can I have an opinion about you, Vicki? It's you who knows about you.
Right,
so my
right.
job is to help you access what is true for you, not throw an opinion on top of you. And the stages are just opinions that have been debunked over and over. And yet Elizabeth did brilliant things. This one thing got out of hand and became something it was never meant to be.
Oh, that's interesting. That's really interesting. But are there some common responses? Well, you deal with so many people. Are there definitely some common responses?
Yes, and they tend to be physical. And I love your question. It's perfectly worded. What is most typical for most grieving people in the very beginning upon learning of the death, either by phone or being in the room when someone dies their last breath, is the most common immediate reaction is a sense of numbness. It's almost like a thermostat is, but what do you call it, when an electrical circuit has been broken, it kind of shuts you off a little
bit.
Almost because the pain you might feel would be too much to bear, so it kind of shuts off the circuit breaker. After you come out of that, and that's usually a relatively short time, hours or days, what is the most common response for most people is an inability to concentrate or focus, and that can last for days or weeks and even months, and some people even longer. And that is where you're in one room, you decide to go in another room and do something. When you get there, you go, what in the heck am I doing here? Because the death, the preoccupation, the emotion, the feelings, the thoughts takes over and you can't think squarely. It's why people don't do well at work. And what we can tell you is this. When your heart is broken, your head doesn't work right. And when your heart is broken, your spirit doesn't soar because the heart is the dominating part of you when something sad or painful happens. So that's common. The other couple of common things is that eating habits and sleeping patterns may be disrupted. And the fourth major commonality is a roller coaster of emotions, highs and lows, and then just kind of being blah. Those are common, and yet none of those could be called stages. And yet the closest thing to universal is the inability to concentrate, but we would never call it a stage. We would call it a typical common reaction to overwhelming information.
Okay, I must be permanently in that state. I forget all the time what I went into a room for.
Well, going out of the moment is a whole other issue. It tends to have a correlation to unresolved grief, but I'm not going to say that about you. But if you do some of the work in that book, it may start to change that ability to stay more present. Again, I'm not attacking you at all,
okay,
but staying
yeah.
present is a huge issue in life.
Sure, sure. Now, you talk about things that, you know, we hear commonly, oh, don't worry, there's, like divorce, there's more fish, there's better fish in the sea, or time heals all wounds, or
yep.
somebody betrays you. You know, shame on them. I mean, these are all things that people say in a very well-meaning manner. They mean to
they mean well, but
to
the impact
you.
Is terrible. When I was 15 and I had my first ever romantic breakup, my heart was broken a million pieces. My mother, who loved me, said, "Don't feel bad, honey. There are plenty of fish in the sea," which mm-hmm. was the first time I knew I had been dating a fish. I thought it was this nice girl named Wanda, to make another joke.
Well, there is a fish called Wanda, yeah.
And the point there, the myth of that is replace the loss. Well, relationships are not interchangeable. It's not like you can undo a light bulb and put a new one in. Relationships have an emotional connection with humans, with animals, even with physical things like cars and homes. The other one you just touched on, I think we're short on time, but the biggest, most pernicious myth is the myth that time heals all wounds. And I'll just do a short version of this. Time can't heal your broken heart any more than time could put air in a flat tire. It requires actions. And the Grief Recovery Handbook is about what actions you need to take to discover and complete what is left emotionally unfinished as a result of a death, a divorce, an estrangement, or any change in anything important in your life. So that's why the handbook, the subtitle is the Action Program. It's not a talking program. It's not even necessarily always about feelings, although feelings usually accrue to this. It's about what actions do I take so that I can complete my relationship to the pain and isolation caused by loss of any kind.
Okay, so if I'm not going to use any of these placations to talk to people when they are grieving, it's very difficult to know what to say to people. I usually tell them I don't know what to say, but I'm
Perfect.
Here if you need me.
Oh, Vicki, I give you a big hug right on this telephone. And they probably say, oh, Vicki was the only one who didn't make me angry by what she said, because people say, don't feel bad, she's in a better place. But the griever's not in a better place.
Right.
Now,
right.
The other good thing to say is, gosh, I heard what happened, and I can't imagine what this has been like for you, which is a way of non-interrogatively asking a question. The question is really, how do you feel, without making them naked to have to tell you because they're afraid you'll judge them and say they shouldn't feel that way. So, and I've said that probably 100,000 times. Gosh, I can't imagine what it's been like for you, with my voice going up in the end, making a little question out of a statement. And no one has ever done anything but then tell me how they feel. Mm. And if I had said, how do you feel, they'd say, well, I'm fine. Mm. Yet So everyone listening, just learn to say, I can't imagine what it's been like for you. And I almost can guarantee to 100% that no one will be offended. And if they don't want to talk, they won't talk. But it's the best way to get them to open, because they'll know that means you're not going to judge them and tell them that they shouldn't feel bad.
Okay. And we are almost at the end of the segment, Russell, but I want to leave our listeners with some positive action here. If they've been in a grieving situation, or they feel they maybe didn't get over something that happened years ago, and it's time to do that, is there one thing in particular, above all else, that they should do?
Yes. What they have to do is find someone safe where they can tell the truth about themselves and how they feel without being judged or criticized for being human. And if they have any trouble, they can call here, 818-907-9600. They can find our numbers on the website. And if they need someone just for a short time to listen to them tell the truth because they don't have anyone, I will listen to them. I can't necessarily give them 1,000 hours of time, but I will. And what I want to recommend is that if they don't have money, go to the library and get to the bookstore and get a copy of the Grief Recovery Handbook. It is a life-altering book, but they need the book and the actions. But they need to tell the truth about themselves, because it's the only thing that will get them out of their emotional prison.
Absolutely. And what would you like to leave our listeners with today?
I'd like to leave them with an honoring of you and your station for having us on your air, for helping them hear something. And I want them to know that the only problem they have courage and willingness. Now they need better information. When the grief things come, they need better information. It's available. Like I say, we've donated thousands of our books to libraries so they can go get the help. We don't need mm-hmm. to make them money. We need them to get better.
Yeah. And I'm going to be really honest here, Russell, because my father died 5 years ago. It was very, very difficult for me because I had to hold it all together for everybody else.
Right.
Like you talk about there. But when I came back to America, people were very supportive and wanted to send me to all kinds of support groups and give me books. I'm not into support groups. They wouldn't have worked for me, but this book certainly would have done. It's really, really great information.
By the way, this may sound a little odd. We're not into support groups. We have 12-week facilitated outreach program groups run by people we've trained. Support groups, sadly, sometimes support pain rather than recovery.
That's what I want to tell you.
Guess where I go twice a year now and deliver trainings?
Support, I don't know, where
no,
do you
London.
Go?
You know,
oh, you
I
go to London?
London? And I go
yes,
twice
did,
a year.
Yeah.
We have a partner in London. We have a whole website over there, and we do trainings there so people have access to our methods over there. So I'm very excited about that.
Yeah, and that's the whole thing with you're not there to support the pain. You're there to help people move through it.
Yes, we're there. We're
awesome.
Only about recovery. We're not about grief. We're about recovery from grief, which is a whole other arena.
Well, I thank you for being with us today. Great information.
Vicki, anytime. And I love you, and I love your listeners.
Thank you so much, Russell.
Okay, bye.
And again, my guest, Russell Friedman, his book, The Grief Recovery Handbook, The Action Program for Moving Beyond Death, Divorce, and Other Losses, including Health, Career, and Faith. And you can find out more about Russell at grief.net. Grief.net. Really great information up there. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be joined by Tim Link of Wagging Tales. Stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Hi, I'm Andrea Kay, America's leading career expert. I know it's going to be a great conversation when Vicki St. Clair asked me to offer my career advice on her show. Vicki asks thoughtful questions, she's thorough, she works hard to bring you great guests who walk their talk with information and solutions that can lift your career and better your life so that you'll live well, live strong. My advice? Tune into our conversations and all the interviews on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair for thought-provoking insight and tips on the things that really matter in your life. and visit AndreaKay.com. That's Andrea, K-A-Y.com, for information about my books and loads of free practical advice and inspiration for your career.
If you missed a show on Conversations Live, check out conversationslive.net for dozens of free podcasts. Topics range from health and healing to business and career growth, from personal development to creativity, adventure, and the challenges of the human spirit. See conversationslive.net for talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. conversationslive.net, making a difference one word at a time.
Commune with the Pop Oracle on the Radio 8 Ball Show. I'm Andras Jones, the host of the Radio 8 Ball Show, where we answer your questions by picking songs at random and interpreting them as the answers, like picking musical tarot cards. That's the Radio 8 Ball Show on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Don't miss the Radio 8 Ball Show, now at its new time, Wednesdays at noon, here on Alternative Talk, 1150.
There's nothing else like it on the dial. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. My guest in this segment is Tim Link. He's the president and CEO of Wagging Tales, T-A-L-E-S. He uses his ability there to communicate with animals to help build stronger relationships between humans and their animal companions. Excuse me. He's been featured on many TV and radio programs across the world and joins us today to tell us that every animal has a tail. So, Tim, the first question, welcome, first of all, to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And I want to say you've written a cute little book. It's called Wagging Tales, Every Animal Has a Tail, T-A-L-E. The first question I want to ask you, you are now a full-time animal communicator. You do Reiki on animals. But for more than 20 years, I read in your book, you were in sales, in telecommunications. Quite a career change there. So tell us how that came about for you.
Yeah, definitely. You know, I'd spent 20 years in telecom and climbed that corporate ladder. I was selling technology packages for cellular phones and getting CEOs of major corporations to spend $20, $30 million on our technology and, climbed up the ladder and had a great career and was vice president and director of a major telecom corporation. But in February 2004, my life was going to change. There was a gift that presented itself, a gift to be able to connect with animals at a very deep level, to understand them and to communicate with them, to get information from them that you want to know from the animals, and in return, information they want to share with you, thus building the best relationship possible. And, you know, when it presented itself, it was very interesting. It was very cool because I had this love affair for animals. I did a lot of work with animals. I worked with animal rescue organizations and, you know, always wanted to connect with the animals at a deeper level. But I had no idea it was going to be at this, this deep and this intensive. And so for the first, couple, 3 years, I sort of, kept it a little quiet. I wasn't sure how these two were going to play out. It wasn't like I could go into a CEO's office and, tell him that, hey, if you buy $30 million worth of my software IP today, I'll come by and tell you why Fluffy's not using the litter box. So, the two weren't going to quite play hand in hand. But I continued to work on it. I worked with my own pets, and the gift continued to grow. I started working with a few friends' pets and helping them out with problems and issues, and the gift continued to grow from there. Then we got more involved with animal rescue and later became president of our local humane society, and that afforded me more opportunities to help out. And finally, in 2007, the gift was so overwhelming, and I was receiving emails and phone calls from people around the world, people that were having challenges with their pets, whether it be physical, mental, or emotional challenges, people that had lost pets and they were desperately trying to locate them and bring them home, and animals and people, animals going through the transition process ready to pass on, and people trying to learn how to make those right decisions for what's best for the animal. And finally, in 2007, I said, I really have to have some guidance. Is this really what I'm supposed to be doing, is giving the animals a voice and helping people out? And, my confirmation came through loud and clear that this is really what I'm supposed to be doing.
Well, tell us
so
how
I left it.
Tell us how that came to you, because you said a couple of times the opportunity presented itself to communicate with animals. I mean, how did this come to you?
And you
also said you kept it quiet for a couple of years. So I'm assuming you thought people might be skeptical of this. Was that the thought going on there?
Yeah, well, it was. You know, the gift presented itself. My wife and I went to a little half day workshop. And the workshop was, it was her birthday weekend. I thought it would be a lot of fun. We were going to go there there were going to be about a dozen or so people there that loved animals and wanted to learn how to connect with them, have a better relationship with them. And the little workshop basically was designed to calm our minds, open our hearts, and center ourselves. So things like, you know, meditation time, quiet time, a lot of visualization work, things to sort of get you to slow down a little bit. Get you to think about how you can connect at a deeper level, to go back to the roots on how we communicate when we're first born as infants.
Mm.
You know, we don't have vocabularies at that point, so we have to communicate with our parents in some fashion. And so we spent time doing that. And during the workshop, towards the end of the workshop, they had pets there at the workshop. People would bring in pictures of their pets, and they would ask questions. And most of the questions at that time were fairly simple. Questions like, you know, where does Spot like to sleep? Where does Winnie like to eat her hay? Where does Fluffy like to use the litter box? Things of this sort. And we would connect with the animals. We would get information back. In those days, when it happened to me, it was a form of a couple of words or a couple of pictures. And I would jot down that information. I would share it back with the owner. And I thought, well, this is going to be kind of fun. We'll see how it goes. But we had 12 people in the class. Each person had 4 or 5 pictures. We had 4 or 5 questions for each of the animals. So we're talking well over 100 questions.
Mm-hmm.
And every one of them were coming through loud and clear, and they were absolutely correct. They were accurate.
So I'm sorry. Go ahead.
So at that point, you know, that's when you start to think, wow, you know, this is pretty amazing. Is it a fluke? You know, should I go be playing the lottery today? Maybe I'm on a roll or something. And then what do you do with this? Because it's slowly but surely becoming more and more accepted, and more people realize it's happening, and that the universe is quite broad and vast, and there's a lot more things out there than we realize.
Mm.
But we're not quite there yet.
Mm.
And so how do you tell your friends and your family and your boss that, hey, you know what, I can talk to your pets?
Yeah, you really. And you say in the book that as kids, we are much more intuitive with animals. I can certainly relate to that because I grew up with a lot of animals, and you do talk to them on a different level than you do when you're an adult. But tell me how you communicate with them. Do you actually, is it words? Is it body language?
Well, the interesting thing, body language has very little, if anything, to do with it. As a matter of fact, you know, I do private consultations with people and their pets, and 95% of them are done over the phone. All I have is a picture of the pet, the name of the pet. We set up a phone consultation. You ask questions that you want to know. I can connect with the animal's energy. They share back information to me in the form that they feel most comfortable with. So it could be pictures, it could be colors, feelings, emotions, words. The whole gamut of things we go through and the whole sensations we go through as humans, our animals go through as well. And it's up to each one of the animals to communicate in the fashion that they feel most comfortable with. And each individual animal has their own personality. So some of them are very outgoing, very flamboyant. You know, they give a lot of pictures, colors, feelings, words, and emotions. And other ones are a little bit more subdued. They don't share as much information, or maybe they only communicate in one or two fashions. I receive that information back, share that with the owner, and we determine what that means. And then we set up a game plan to figure out what we need to do with that.
Now, have you ever had an animal refuse to communicate with you?
I haven't. You know, I've never had a situation where that's happened. And I do believe it's because, you know, I'm putting myself out there. I'm opening my heart and mind to be able to connect and give the animals a voice. And they desperately want to tell us. They desperately want to know what we need from them to have a great life, and in return, what we can do for them to have a great life.
Mm.
And that's what I do, is I give the animals a voice and help you build that best relationship possible between you and the animals.
What do you think most people could do to build a better relationship with their pet? You don't just do pets. I mean, you do all kinds of animals. You talk with or communicate with all kinds of animals, right?
Yeah, all animals can communicate in this fashion. So, you know, I do, you know, the most common work is with, you know, dogs, horses, and cats. our typical domestic animals, but I also do a lot of work with zoos and aquariums and sanctuaries. So we work from everything from lions to tigers to bears.
I have to tell you, I'm somewhat on the skeptical side, as you probably know, but I do know people who very much believe in this. I have one friend who regularly takes her horses to a lady up here in the Northwest for issues. And I saw on the back of your book that Jack from the San Diego Zoo, I used to know him many, many years ago, gave you a blurb there and said that, he's worked, is his name Jack Hanna? It's Jack Hanna.
Jack Hanna, the director emeritus at the Columbus Zoo, sure.
Right, and he said there that work all these years working with animals, they never fail to amaze him, the depths that they can go to sometimes.
Absolutely, and that's one of those things that this gift and everything that's presented itself is just keeps growing larger and larger every day. And when we wrote the book, Wagging Tails, Every Animal Has a Tail, it's a collection of 32 stories of animals that I've worked with and helped solve problems and find lost animals and help people with their pets. And it also has 24 helpful hints in there, little tips, things you need to know today. And so when we wrote the book, we thought, well, of course, you got to have endorsements for a book if you're going to put one out there. And we've always been a fan of Jack Hanna's, always admired his work, and took the opportunity to send him a book, have him read it, see what he thinks about it, and came back with the glowing endorsement. They've invited us up. We just got back a couple weeks ago from the Columbus Zoo. We were visiting the zoo and did a speaking signing up there. And, that has opened up more opportunities to talk to animals in zoos and sanctuaries and things across the world. So mm-hmm. it's been a real blessing. And, it's one of those things where, skeptical or not, it's okay. But you have to realize that the animals do communicate, and you see the results and see the things that happen and how we can help you build that great relationship.
Oh, definitely.
And better understanding. Yeah. And it's just amazing.
Yeah, definitely. I definitely think some people have a very much closer connection. We're going to take a quick break. I know that you do a lot of work on behavior with animals. And so when we come back, I'd like to run through some of those issues that you help resolve. My guest today is Tim Link. His new book is called Wagging Tails, Every Animal Has a Tail. And you're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
You were away, but there were planes to catch and bills to pay. He learned to walk while I was away, and he was talking for I knew it.
Looking for unconditional love, an exercise buddy, or a great listener? Paws has the dog or cat of your dreams, just waiting to meet you. We've made thousands of perfect matches since 1967 because everyone needs a warm, safe place to call home. Find out more today at paws.org or call 425-787-2500.
Hi, this is Julie Forbes. Join me on Wednesday afternoons from 2 to 3 p.m. for the Dog Talk Show, an evolved perspective on life with dogs. Listen to discussions on dog-related topics and call in to voice your opinion or ask my opinion about your dog. We will talk about everything from dog behavior to pet food to dog training programs in prisons. The Dog Talk Show, an evolved perspective on life with dogs. I'm your host, Julie Forbes. Tune in Wednesdays from 2 to 3 p.m. on Alternative Talk 1150.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to help you heal and stay healthy.
Don't forget, this is Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. My guest is Tim Link. He is the president and CEO of Wagging Tails, T-A-L-E-S. And he's also the author of Wagging Tails, Every Animal Has a Tail. And Tim is an animal communicator and Reiki practitioner. Let's look, first of all, Tim, how you work with animals and Reiki.
Reiki is a hands-off energy modality, so it works a lot like massage or acupuncture, things of this sort, which are more hands-on. This works on a hands-off approach, and it works to clear out any stagnant energy within the animal or any blockages. So it's that old terminology of, my energy's flowing good today. You know, when you hear that, that means that everything's lined up perfectly, all your chakras are lined up, everything's flowing smoothly, and you're clicking at a real good pace, you're feeling good, and everything's great. And that's the same thing our animals go through. So what we do with Reiki is we scan the body to determine what's going on, see if that energy is flowing smoothly. If there's an area that is blocked, then we go to use more intensive Reiki energy on that area to see if we can open it up to get that energy to flow smoothly. And it's also a great indicator on what is going on with your animal's life, whether it's mental, physical, or emotional. These blockages can cause any of these things to present themselves, and the Reiki will work to push it out.
Yeah.
So, you know, we got a great example. We got several examples, but there's a wonderful story in the book, Wagging Tails, Every Animal Has a Tail, about a cat that insisted that I talk to it and do Reiki energy. And when I did it, there was a blockage around the area that would look like would be the kidneys. And we continued to work with it, and it got to the point where I couldn't open it up, and suggested to the human companion, the owner of the animal, that she take the cat in to get the urinalysis done and get the kidneys checked. And she did. The vet was quite skeptical, didn't know why she wanted to spend the money on this, but did the test anyway and come to find out the cat was in early stages of a kidney disease.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah. So we caught it early on, got some food changes, medicine added into the system, got new herbs and things, and the cat's doing great. So.
Yeah. Well, I was looking around your website, and you've got some really useful articles on there. You talk a lot about behavioral issues. You mentioned earlier that you used to be president of a no-kill shelter. One of the things I liked in the book, at the end, you've got more tips from Tim at the end of the book, and you say, if you leave the house for any reason, tell your pets where you're going. Now, skeptical or not, I always do that.
Good.
So why should we always tell our pets where we go?
Well, you know, our pets have a great deal of anxiety when we leave them alone in the house. Now, it can be the same routine you do every day. You know, you could go to work at the same time, come back, everything's the same. But they're still wondering what's going on, where are you going, when will you be back, and what are they to do while you're gone? That's the most important part. They want a job to do, even if it's a simple one like lay down and take a nap. So I always tell people that you want to verbally, out loud, tell them where you're going, when you'll be back, and what are they to do. So Spot, I'm going to go to work today. I'm going to be back home in 8 hours, which is 6 o'clock. I need you to lay down and take a long nap. Look out the window. Give them something to do. And amazingly enough, we've got stories in the book about that, where cats and dogs have had some behavior changes. And it's because the routine had been changed, and nobody explained it to the animal. So we went back to this verbalization and talking to the animal and letting them know where you're going, when you'll be back, and what are they to do. The personalities and everything changed back with the animal, and the animal started doing well again.
Mm.
So it's very important to do, and they do understand what you're saying.
Yeah, you know, years ago, I have a border collie now who is just phenomenal. Years ago, I had another wonderful dog. He was a cross between a spaniel and some kind of collie. And when my then husband and I would take him to the beach, he whined incessantly as soon as we got about 10 miles away from the beach, because he knew that's where we were going. And one day, after weeks of this, I turned around to him and I said, Ben, you have a choice. You either be quiet and we'll go to the beach, or we're going home. And that little dog shut up and didn't whine again.
That's right. That's why the parents tell their children, don't make me stop this car.
I know. So I don't know what they are understanding there, but something's going in.
Well, you know, I always tell people, I try to break it down to as simplistic method as possible, because what we're doing here, you know, though it's different and it's not totally the norm yet, it's still very simple. And when you break it down to the most simplistic forms, you tend to understand it a little bit better. So when I tell people to talk to their pets out loud, I'm telling them that the animals understand the words that you're saying. Secondly, when you say the words, the visualization comes out very clearly. Even if it's subconsciously, that visualization comes out. And animals are very visual creatures. And third, your energy goes up because you talked about it and you feel better. So I can give you, if you got 2 seconds, I'll give you a test. If you're ready for a test, real quick one here.
Yep.
This is a real good one. I'm going to tell you, I'm going to say two words. And when I'm done with those two words, you let me know if you heard the words and if you saw the words.
Okay.
Okay? So the two words are orange ball. Mm-hmm. Orange ball.
And I saw and heard. Saw
yeah.
and heard, yeah.
Okay, so that, and that's why I ask people, you heard the words orange ball,
mm-hmm.
and did you see an orange ball of some sort?
Yes, I did.
Exactly, and that's what the animals are picking up. Now, my visualization of what I'm trying to project to you of an orange ball may be slightly different. Mine may have been a beach ball, maybe you saw a basketball or a tennis ball or something of that sort. So sometimes we have to go back and repeat it with the animals until they finally get that visualization of what you're putting out there. But they hear the words, they understand that, they see that visualization that automatically comes out. And the third thing is you've gotten it off your chest. You've said the words, you feel better about it, so your energy goes up, and they respond to very positive upward energy.
Mm.
And that's why you see the animals respond. So talk to your pets by all means.
Right, right. Now, what's probably one of the most common problems that you see that people bring their pets to you or talk to you about? Because you don't see everybody face-to-face, I realize.
Right.
Yeah.
Fluffy will no longer use the litter box. That's the... If I had a dollar for every time I heard that, I'd probably own my own radio station or something. I don't know. But you know, it's amazing because cats are incredible creatures. You know, typically they're very independent, and typically we allow them to have their independence, so we don't always check in with them all the time. They're not there beside us all the time. We let them do their own thing, typically. Well, in order to get our attention, the best way to do that is to stop using the litter box. Now, from there, we have to determine why is it that they stop using the litter box. Is it a physical thing? You know, maybe they've got a urinary tract infection or bladder infection or something physically going on with them, and we've got to get them checked out by a veterinarian to get that solved. Is it an emotional thing? Maybe there's been a lot of negative energy brought into the house. Maybe you've been upset, not at them particularly, but just upset in general. Maybe a new animal's been brought into a house or a person's moved out of the house. So emotional things will definitely impact them as well.
Mm.
Or it could be, you know, a mental thing that's going on with them, something that is mentally impacting them that is affecting their day-to-day life, which could be, you know, bringing another animal permanently into the household. Can definitely have some mental impact on your animal if you're not explaining it to them in advance and give them a chance to work with that animal and get to know that animal in advance.
Right, right.
So once we determine what that is, and that's where I help you out, then we can communicate with the animal, solve the problem, and everybody's happy again.
Yes, and I was just thinking as we're talking here of another example of where my dog talks to me. I like to sing in the car, I confess. And my dog, when I first had him, was sitting in the passenger seat, and he looked at me out the corner of his eye like to say, you know, how much longer is this going to go on? And eventually, I didn't stop, and eventually he got up and climbed into the back of the car in a most disgusted way.
Because he was trying to tell you, and you were probably picking up on it, but you didn't act upon it.
Hey, it's my car, yeah. And I like to sing.
Well, hey, you know, you got to explain that to them that, hey, here's the situation. I know you think my singing's atrocious, but what I need you to do is deal with it because it's not going to get any better, and this is going to make mommy very happy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I always tell them when you're talking to people, it's just like when you're leaving the house and you're telling them where you're going, when you'll be back, and what are they to do. When you're talking to them, make sure you're telling them what the situation is, what they need to do about it, and most importantly, why is going to be a good thing. Why would they want to do that? And when you're explaining to them very clearly like that, you feel good about the conversation. They understand what you're saying, and they tend to respond a lot better to you.
Yeah. Well, Tim, you are a delight, and I can tell why you work so well with animals. I'm sure they love you. What would you like to leave our listeners with today?
Well, the best thing is, you know, if you have any questions at all, whether they're serious or not, that's where an animal communicator can come into play. If you really want to build the best relationship possible between yourself and your animals, that's where I can help you out. So I'm here to give the animals a voice and help you build that best relationship possible. So, you know, I encourage people to, you know, if you haven't done it already, take a look at the website, which is wagging-tales.com, wagging-tales.com. It's full of all kinds of wonderful information, helpful hints, little tips. And you can also sign up for my free e-newsletter, which comes out the first of every month. So that's tomorrow.
Okay.
September issue will come out. And not only will that keep you abreast of everything going on with Wagging Tales, all the appearances, the books, and all that good stuff. But more importantly, there's wonderful tips we include in every little newsletter that'll help you build that best relationship possible between you and the animals.
Yeah, and you also archive your newsletters, and there were some really good articles on there, short articles, which we didn't get time to discuss today, but such as how to find a good pet sitting. That's a good pet sitting company, because that's an important issue when you run off. Okay, we're out of time. I'm getting the signal here from Mike. So next week is Labor Day weekend. We have a great show lined up for you, and then we'll be back with a whole new live show on September 14th. Have a wonderful holiday weekend. Thanks for being with us today. Until next week, live well, live strong.